This is Ned Ryan, and welcome to the History of the Constitutional Convention, Episode 2. In last week's podcast, I discussed some of the background that led up to the Constitutional Convention, briefly touching on the Revolutionary War, and then an examination of the Articles of Confederation and the serious problems created by that document. Quite frankly, the Articles worked during the war, or I should say the last 7 months of the Revolution, well, because of the Revolution. But once the war was done, and even before the Treaty of Paris in 1783, the newly independent United States was starting to come apart at the seams. By 1783, it was becoming clear that the Articles, ratified only 2 years before, were virtually unworkable. The Articles of Confederation worked during the Revolutionary War because it was really, for all intents and purposes, a gentleman's agreement. There was nothing really binding about the Articles, no real way to enforce them throughout the various states. Think of 13 sticks bound together by a rope, but you remove the rope and the sticks will fall apart. That's what took place. 13 states, viewing themselves as individual entities, started falling apart after the Revolution because after the peace with Great Britain, the threat of Great Britain was gone. George Washington would say of the system of government under the Articles that it was a shadow without substance, and was known to have described the Congress as a half-starved, limping government that appears to always be moving upon crutches and tottering at every step. Things were going so poorly in the newly independent United States that Washington commented to a friend that something had to be done to avert the humiliating and contemptible figure we are about to make on the annals of mankind. And this less than 10 years after American independence, when Sam Adams of Massachusetts had declared that America would be a model to the world, a Christian Sparta. Those words seemed a bit hollow in the mid-1780s. Due to the Articles, there was a weakness for the United States in international affairs. Because of Congress's inability to tax, there was an inability to pay foreign creditors. The Confederation Congress had no power to compel Great Britain, or even the individual states, to actually abide by the Treaty of Paris. Congress would meet, but it had no power to tax. It had no power to have a standing army. Foreign powers could be dismissive of the newly independent United States, as Spain demonstrated by closing the Mississippi to American navigation in 1784. And if you think that the Spanish didn't have serious interests about gaining a foothold in America, the Spanish recruited a young American officer in Kentucky by the name of James Wilkinson, who actually took an oath of allegiance to the King of Spain. In return for money, Wilkinson began to urge his fellow Kentuckians and others in the western lands to secede and enter into trade agreements with Spain. Spain had already secured Florida and the southern part of what is now Mississippi and Alabama, which Spain called East Florida. Spain also held New Orleans and was intent on swaying more of the western territories her way. The seriousness of the issue was realized by Washington, who would say of the westerners that the touch of a feather could turn them any way. Debt owed to British merchants, Great Britain refused to leave its forts in North America. Quite frankly, the inability of the Congress to pay off those debts was because the various state legislatures obstructed the collection of such debts. By now you might have caught the drift here that the state legislatures were severely damaging the United States. But back to the main point. Because the U.S. was defaulting on these debts, Great Britain stayed in its forts along the Great Lakes, at Lake Champlain, Ogdensburg, Oswego, and Niagara. And there were two other British outposts at Detroit and Michilimackinac. And of course, you can't forget the Barbary Pirates, who as early as 1785 were capturing American ships and holding the ships, crews, and passengers for ransom. In the face of all of this, all the United States could do was sit helpless and take the abuse of the Spanish and the British and the pirates. In 1787, America only had a standing army of 700 men, and the Secretary of War, Henry Knox, had a staff of 3 clerks because he couldn't afford any more. The United States was truly a weak and impotent player on the international stage because Congress was subservient to the state legislatures. In addition to damaging the United States in international affairs, the weakness of the Articles also had serious implications for domestic policy. Congress had no power to tax, no power over interstate commerce, couldn't pay its debts, from foreign debts to money owed to war veterans. Congress could not resolve interstate disputes, from a separatist movement that broke Vermont away from New York and established itself as an independent state to Shay's rebellion in Pennsylvania, which I'll touch on in more detail later, to armed conflict between Connecticut settlers and Pennsylvania troops over some disputed land. It was becoming chaotic in the states. But as historian Peter Onuf Wright points out, the Articles of Confederation were premised on the existence of 13 distinct political communities and effectively barred a coordinated response to national political problems. Without a strong central government to check their power, or I should say a government which even had the ability to check them, state legislatures looked out for their own interests and their own blessed state sovereignty, and in short, misused and abused their authority. Since the Confederation Congress was unable to regulate interstate commerce, it was left to the individual states, which proved disastrous. Now, this point of interstate commerce might seem a minor one, but let me explain its ramifications. In 1785, when American commissioners attempted to make trade agreements with Britain, the British ambassador refused, because he knew that any state could, and probably would, decline to abide by Congress's trade regulations. So what was the point in signing a trade agreement? This inability of Congress to regulate commerce on a national scale then led to the formation of a committee dedicated to appealing to the states to grant Congress enlarged powers over commerce. Essentially, Congress was saying to the various state legislatures, please, 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 give us more power over trade and commerce. To which the state legislatures said, well, that's very nice, but we like things just the way they are. And no effective action was taken. Again, as I mentioned earlier, essentially each state thought it was a sovereign nation and acted as such, looking out for its own best interests. 9 of the states had their own navy at this time, and there were, of course, 13 state militias. They moved and operated like a collection of small countries in Europe, most of the times peaceful with each other, but no one trusted the other states entirely, and each was looking out for its own best interests, the interests of its many sovereign nation. This idea of each state being a sovereign nation had a dramatic economic impact on the newly independent United States. Faced with a post-war economic depression, with prices and real wages falling, indebtedness growing, and interstate trade near disaster, state legislatures many times imposed high tariffs on importations from other states. States with large populations, such as New York and Massachusetts, economically exploited their smaller neighbors, such as Delaware, Connecticut, and New Jersey. To compound the economic problems, remember that Congress had no authority to tax. So, to make matters worse, Congress printed up $200 million in paper money, with the promise that the states would subsequently redeem that paper money with their taxes. But instead of taxing their citizens, the states in turn printed another $200 million in paper money, flooding the U.S. economy with $400 million in paper money that was backed by nothing. This printing of huge amounts of almost worthless paper money was an attempt to boost the sagging economies. But those printing the money did not quite understand that with more money in circulation, they were in fact bringing on terrible inflation. In the end, the continental dollar would be worth less than a penny, coining the term not worth a continental. In 1780, you could purchase a sheep for $150 in continentals or $2 in hard currency. The resulting inflation was so severe that in some areas, creditors, not debtors, fled from those who owed them, not wanting to settle debts with worthless bills. Some states passed bills trying to force people to use the paper money as though it had any intrinsic value, and laws were passed that stated if a merchant did not accept the paper money, he would forfeit his goods to the customer with no further payment. To make matters worse, there wasn't even agreement on what the actual value of a pound sterling was. Was it 1,289 grams, as in Virginia, or only 1,031, like in Pennsylvania? On top of that, some states implemented price fixing, which only created shortages of products. And as sadly the story throughout time, some enterprising and crooked politicians took advantage of the situation. The Rhode Island legislators passed regulations during this period to take advantage of the economic crisis, and deliberately and legislatively managed to line their pockets with nice profits, earning them the nickname Rogue Island, and prompting their neighbors to wish the state would fall off into the sea. They issued $100,000 in paper money that by law had to be accepted on the same terms as gold, which was quite convenient for the many debtors sitting in the Rhode Island legislature. The legislators of Rhode Island had no intention of consenting to a stronger form of national government that might actually rein them in. And of the 13 states, Rhode Island was the only state not to send any delegates to the Constitutional Convention. 13 businessmen from the state, mortified at their legislators' behavior, would actually send a letter to the Constitutional Convention apologizing for their state. George Washington was very concerned with what he called the American character. After the defeat of Great Britain, the United States was fracturing before it had even really begun. As Washington would say, we have errors to correct. And he felt strongly that if the Articles of Confederation were not dealt with and changed, and America didn't have a better form of government, the Revolutionary War might have been fought in vain. Now, I've already discussed the threats of Great Britain, Spain, and the internal and oftentimes armed conflicts between the various states. I haven't even mentioned the situation with the Indians on the western borders. Joseph Brant, a Mohawk and a captain in the British Army, was organizing thousands of Indians to fight off American expansion to the west. In the south, Alexander McGilvery, a half-breed, was organizing thousands of Indians to terrorize American settlers. Many times, the Indians were spurred to action by the British and Spanish. It has to be realized that the newly independent United States was in a very precarious place in the 1780s, and something had to be done and done quickly. Now, I want to give you a better feel for what America was like in the 1780s. I think that in the 21st century, we have a hard time understanding that America was not always the superpower that it is today. Though it was a large country geographically at the time, stretching 1,200 miles from north to south and 200 miles from the Atlantic inland, it was a small country population-wise, far on the reaches of a world that was still very much Eurocentric. In the late 1700s, America was for the most part, compared to the European powers, a small agrarian society. In the 1780s, 90% of the white American men were farmers. And an interesting side note, the average height of American men at the time was 5 feet 8 inches, which is not that far off today's average, and was probably due to the fact that there was a very high protein-rich diet of deer, beef, and all sorts of other protein sources that walked or scurried around on two or four legs. America in 1787 was on the verge of industrial and scientific expansion, but it wasn't quite there yet. Eli Whitney's cotton gin was coming soon. Samuel Slatter had recently set up a spinning factory. Coal was beginning to be utilized, but this was all very much at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. Today we travel on 6 or 8 lane highways, tooling down the road at 65 miles an hour, or maybe a little faster. But back then you traveled by horse or coach, most of the time on roads that were hacked out of the forests, and you crossed over dozens of creeks and rivers along the way, most of which were unbridged. Unless you think that traveling along the rutted roads was bad enough, coaches would oftentimes tip over or mire in the mud. During the spring, when trying to cross rivers, coaches could be swept away, and it wasn't unusual for travelers to be drowned. If you were lucky, you could travel 50 miles a day by coach, but many times you often averaged about 20. If you wished to travel by sea, it would still take you about 10 days to reach Boston if you sailed from Charleston. To give another perspective on what America was like in the 1780s, consider this. In a day and age where we expect certain amenities when we travel, most travelers carried their food with them and would cook it over tavern fires. Squirrel and coffee was a popular meal for dinner. Americans would breakfast on saltfish, beefsteaks, broiled fowls, ham and bacon, oysters and shad. Bostonians ate fish every Saturday, and horror of horrors, tablecloths were used instead of napkins to clean fingers and wipe mouths at the taverns. Quite frankly, I really don't want to imagine how often those tablecloths were cleaned. And in an interesting dietary note, the average American 15 years or older at the time consumed just under 6 gallons of absolute alcohol each year. The comparable modern average is about 2.9 gallons per capita. And here we thought we had a drinking problem. Though to be fair, in the 18th century, it was looked down upon to be drunk in public, and those 6 gallons of annual consumption were spread out over the course of the year. There was no difference between the classes in America, and it was not unusual to see a member of Congress and a laborer sitting next to each other in a coach, carrying on a conversation. Americans with their own dialects and words were creating a new language. They even started calling the English used in America, American. Over 75% of the population was of British or Irish heritage. 20% were blacks, most of those were slaves. 85% spoke English, and the overwhelming majority were Protestant. Americans were hardworking, God-fearing, and quite frankly, thought they were better than other people. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Remember, too, that the medical advances we take for granted today were unknown then. Bloodletting was still an approved medical practice. In the 1780s, disease was rampant in America, and Philadelphia itself would be ravaged by the yellow fever numerous times in the latter half of the 18th century. There was filth in the streets, wells contaminated by backyard privies. One innkeeper and his wife had 14 children, none of whom lived to see the age of two. In the 1780s, the second largest city in America, behind Philadelphia, was New York City, with a population of roughly 33,000 people. In 1787, the city was still showing the ravages of the Revolutionary War. Boston had less than 20,000 people. Baltimore, a small and poor city, had about 13,000 people, and it was said that there were only 12 lamps to light the entire city. Richmond, Virginia, had about 3,500 residents in 1787, and was still considered one of the 20 largest cities in America at the time. The total population of America was about 3.5 million people. Consider that in the 1780s, Great Britain had 15 million inhabitants, France had 25 million, and the Austrian Empire had about 27 million. It was common knowledge that the European powers thought it was only a matter of time before the United States disintegrated, and men like Washington, Madison, and Hamilton felt a sense of urgency, knowing that if the newly independent states did not reform the Articles, the American dream could very well be over before it had really begun. Now, what was to be done? Here was a relatively poor country, newly independent, without a standing army, no real international status, facing internal and external threats, all the while being torn apart by internal dissension between the 13 states who valued their sovereignty and governed by the weak and deficient Articles of Confederation. Enter James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, who, with George Washington's blessing and support, realized that America was staring disaster straight in the face, and those men fully intended to do something about it. Next week, I'll discuss the Mount Vernon and Annapolis conferences, which will prove important and crucial steps in the events leading up to Philadelphia and the Constitutional Convention.